Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Nicholas Agar, A-G-A-R. He's the senior lecturer in philosophy at University of Victoria, Wellington, New Zealand. He's also the author of Life's Intrinsic Value and a book on cloning called Perfect Copy, and most recently a book called Liberal Eugenics. Welcome, Nicholas.
Hi.
You said that before we got on air that you had read my book, and we have made some similar arguments in our two books, and so I'm delighted to finally have a chance to talk to you about yours, because you make yours with much more philosophical profundity and scholarship. So let's talk first, as philosophers should, about what we mean by liberal and what we mean by eugenics. So when you talk about liberal eugenics, what is the liberal?
Okay, I mean, I guess sort of, liberal is a word with so many meanings, it sort of makes it quite difficult to pin down. But I suppose I take what's sort of the core of liberal arguments to be sort of arguments that place emphasis on individual choice, sort of saying that there are limits to individual choice, but when you can't find a good and powerful moral reason for limiting choice, then in general, people should be free to do as they choose.
So this is different from the American interpretation sometimes of liberal as being equatable to social democratic or welfare state. This is more the liberal and allowing people to make choices.
Yeah. No, it's sort of interesting. I mean, this term has sort of morphed onto the American context. But I take it that sort of, if there was to be sort of, a relationship between left and right, liberal with the small l, in the sense that I've just described, is probably, I guess, slightly more aligned with traditional right-wing positions, even though I don't think the argument that I present is in any way a right-wing one.
Yeah, or libertarian, as we would usually call it in the United States. And then in terms of eugenics, this is a term that's such a political football. So how would you define it and contextualize what you mean by it vis-a-vis what it's meant in the past?
Okay, I don't know if you want to find a term that sort of raises more definitional problems than liberal. You've got one in eugenics. And I guess I always think that there are two schools of thought among philosophers as to how you approach terms and what you should do when you have difficulty defining them. And I always think that it's kind of much better to start off with kind of a rough and ready definition. To sort of think, well, look, let's not sort of spend the rest of our life defining terms. Let's actually come up with some good, sort of worthwhile definitions that are going to sort of be useful to start off an inquiry, and realize that we're going to probably modify our definitions as we go along. But I would think of eugenics as just the idea of producing human beings who are in some significant sense better than the norm for human beings. Where we're sort of, at the outset at least, slightly hazy about what we understand this idea of norm for human beings to be.
Well, the subtitle of your book is A Defense of Human Enhancement, which, so you equate the notion of eugenics with human enhancement. And it has had
had many historical meanings, but I take it that when I mean liberal eugenics, that's the way I intend it.
Eugenics has had a more authoritarian, and that's why for some this sounds like an oxymoron, liberal eugenics, because it has had in the past this more authoritarian interpretation of forcing people to be sterilized and even murder. But you're pointing out that eugenics is this specific notion of genetic and biological improvement of the species.
Yeah. The oxymoron aspect was intentional. You have a word that has such a tainted history as eugenics, associated with all the worst people in the 20th century. One sort of natural reaction is to kind of scrap it, and that's what lots of people who, defend human enhancement do. They tend to say, well, this is definitely not eugenics, because eugenics is what Hitler was trying to do. But
It's interesting that you say that, because in the transhumanist movement, we've had that debate many times, and I'm sympathetic with this liberal argument, with the philosophical argument that we have to rehabilitate the term of eugenics and acknowledge some way that what we're talking about with human enhancement is eugenics, as you have done. But many transhumanists would prefer, even though they're carving out ideological space, which is far more problematic for most people than the term eugenics, they don't want to touch that term with a 10-foot pole. So.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's sort of, I mean, I suppose I would characterize my attitude to meaning or definitions of terms as being sort of less hardline than that or the approach taken by many philosophers. So, in a way, I care more about the substance of the position. So if someone were to read the book and say, well, I'm afraid that's not eugenics. Why? Because I think it's essential to the idea of eugenics that you have this sort of this centralized approach to enhancement and sort of massive restrictions on procreative liberty. And I suppose my reaction then would be to say, well, okay, you can have the term. I just want the substance of my position.
I'm speaking with Nicholas Agar. He's the senior lecturer in philosophy at the University of Victoria, Wellington, and the author of, most recently, Liberal Eugenics. And we're talking about the arguments he makes there. You elaborate a method in the book of attempting to avoid some of the yuck factor and non-rational associations without at the same time trying to go to a fully principalist or a completely a quasi-rational approach to moral argument. And you call that the method of moral images. Can you tell us, what do you mean by method of moral images?
Well, I guess the method of moral images, I mean, I guess it's a highfalutin sort of label for something that I think when we do our moral reasoning is just sort of core at the heart of that. And that's this idea of consistency. So I suppose the method of moral images is what I arrived at after discovering that the standard philosophical tools, my starting point is as a moral philosopher, and basically sort of interested in technologies like cloning and genetic engineering, who discovers that the standard tools, the tools that seem to work when you're dealing with interactions with people who are already here, tools like utilitarianism and Kantianism, seem to give you either no answer or just nonsense. So one reaction that you can have is sort of the Leon Kass, and I like your term, by the way, bio-Luddite reaction, which is just to say, well, the only thing we've got to go on here is our gut. These technologies scare us and disgust us, and we should rely on that. And they're thinking, well, no, there's another option. There is this idea of sort of saying, well, look, I mean, yeah, there's nothing that's exactly like inserting sort of additional intelligence genes into a human embryo. We haven't done that before. But there are things that we have done that are maybe similar to it. So I guess sending your child to an elite school, that could be a moral image of genetic enhancement. That's not to say that it's exactly the same as genetically modifying an embryo, but it's similar in some respects. And the way I want to sort of set up the debate is to say, well, look, okay, here's a moral image for genetic enhancement, a way to think about it. If you think this is a bad image, sort of it's bad to sort of in a way apply to transfer the same judgment that you make about sending children to elite schools to genetically enhancing them, well, then you find a difference and find an image that dictates a different reaction.
That example that you're using is in the category of the argument that you're making about nurture, which is certainly an argument that many folks of a transhumanist orientation make, which is that if it's moral to provide all the best for your children after they're born, why isn't it moral to provide all the best for them before they're born, and why should there be a distinction between the two? But some philosophers like Habermas and more recently and others have argued that there is a distinction between crafting a person's being to be a certain way and providing them educational opportunities later. But you don't see that distinction as being as clear.
Yeah, well, I sort of can see that there are differences. I mean, there are differences between a person who has light skin and a person who has dark skin. But I guess to find a difference is not to find a moral difference. I suppose I look at the arguments that Habermas gives and I say, well, I mean, look, there are plenty of, I mean, just to sort of look back at his sort of unquestioning sort of assumptions about nurture, there are plenty of ways in which we nurture people. You know, children are nurtured, which are sort of, well, it ought to be morally problematic in the way that he thinks that genetic enhancement is. And yet, it seems to me that we often don't say that.
Nurturing can be just as restrictive of people's opportunities and their abilities to do things.
Yeah, I think that when nurturing is overly restricted, we should condemn it. And that's why I think that lots of forms of genetic enhancement should be condemned. But probably because they're like, I mean, you can find moral images of sort of specific and oppressive and autonomy-restricting ways to raise children that should be also banned, outlawed.
This gets at one of the very important distinctions that I think your approach, and in which I also agree with, argues that there are cases of genetic modification or germinal choice that should be morally problematic and perhaps legally prescribed. Mm-hmm. And those would be situations where parents are systematically making or clearly announce the intention to make a choice for their future children, which would limit their life opportunities.
Yeah.
And I think of that case, for instance, of a religious subculture who maybe would like to get rid of literacy because they think literacy is the road to, you know, to damnation. And just like we require that children be taught to read in public schools, we should oblige parents to allow their children the opportunity to be literate.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. It's one thing to, to sort of send your child to church every week. I mean, that's basically a choice about how you raise your child. It doesn't prevent your child in sort of later life from sort of saying, well, in actual fact, I have completely different views about religion from you people. I guess there are choices that you make that would make that very difficult for your children, or very difficult for them to sort of live a life that which was directly opposed to the values that guided you in raising them.
The argument that Habermas makes in his book, The Future of the Human Race, or whatever it's called, he argues that, and many Christian fundamentalists and kind of knee-jerk reactions argue that to simply design your child, even if it's to give them extra abilities, extra cognitive abilities or physical abilities or lifespan, that is an unconscionable imposition on the child. And I think you're pointing out that there are some of these restrictions which expand a child's capabilities in life and some which restrict them, and that we need to make that distinction in the law.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are some, I mean, Habermas is probably right about some ways to genetically modify your children. But I mean, I guess there's plenty of examples from the other side of the spectrum. I guess there's sort of plenty of opportunity living ways of educationally enhancing your children. I suppose for some people, I don't know, like I guess for some religious communities, I mean, yeah, not teaching your children to read would be an enhancement. Mm. It makes them better able to perceive the religious truth and less likely to be distracted by bad ideas about God, etc.
Another one of the moral images, which is a familiar one for me, is the notion that there is an unclear distinction between human enhancement and medical therapy in general. Mm-hmm. And particularly when we talk about things like giving people glasses or vaccination or organ transplantation, all these ways in which we already transgress the normative and the normal and the Paleolithic natural. And so in the future, we will have these future technologies which provide extra life, just like we have had in the past. And you're arguing that we should see many of these enhancement technologies as unproblematic, since we see the therapies as unproblematic.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it can be the case that things that we haven't questioned, that we haven't seen fit to question, once you do compare them with sort of certain other ways, I mean, more stark ways to modify human beings, you actually may discover that a reason we should have felt worried about glasses all along. It seems sort of less likely in those kinds of cases. It seems much more likely than rather than the discovering sort of something bad about wearing glasses, that we'll realize, well, okay, they are relevantly similar. There are some differences, but I can't actually find a moral image that sort of tells me that any of those differences matter at all. I guess when I think of sort of like the way consistency can work two ways, I mean, I think often, you know, the comparison with selective breeding. People often say that sort of, you know, agricultural biotechnology is okay because it's really just like selective breeding. And I sort of feel some sympathy for the green argument that sort of says, well, you're not really telling us that agricultural biotechnology in all of its forms is okay. You're telling us that we should have been more worried about selective breeding.
Right.
But I think consistency can go both ways. I mean, saying that two practices are the same doesn't in itself sort of say, well, we should transfer the judgment we make about practice A to practice B. Because it can be the other way around.
I'm speaking with Nicholas Agar. He's a senior lecturer in philosophy at the University of Victoria in Wellington, New Zealand, and the author of the book Liberal Eugenics. Julian Savulescu is now an Oxford philosopher who has made the argument that parents and, I guess, society in general has an obligation to children and the future generations of procreative benevolence and beneficence. situation that he imagines is the in vitro fertilization situation, where you have a number of fertilized embryos to choose which one you're going to implant. And he says you have an obligation to choose the embryo which will have the best opportunities in life. Mm-hmm. And when you extend that to the human enhancement situation, it creates this generalized obligation that we have to use enhancements and perhaps to subsidize them or even make them obligatory in order to ensure that children have the best opportunities in life through these technologies. You have a problem with that, with going that far, however.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's sort of insufficiently liberal in the way that we understood it. Sort of, it seems to me that that would be an approach that would narrow the range of procreative choice, I mean, just about as much as, say, Hitler wanted to. I mean, I guess if of all of the possible children you can have, you're obliged to have one particular children, the children who sort of happens to sort of measure highest on this kind of, this utilitarian scheme that Savulescu is quite keen on. It seems to me that that's a mistake. It sort of doesn't recognize that there are actually, I don't know, I mean, I think average people can have good lives too. And I suppose I think there are lots of sort of different ideas about human excellence there, and to think that there's kind of one metric that you can sort of line all human lives up on oversimplifies things. I guess I'm more of a moral pluralist, someone who sort of says, well, I mean, there are some ideas about, I guess, human enhancement in inverted commas that are just bad and wrong. But if you will exclude those, then there's actually sort of lots of sort of competing different ideas. And within limits, I think we should be free to use procreative or enhancement technologies to pursue them.
I see the argument when there is a situation of trade-offs, and frankly, in most therapies, there are trade-offs. But just take a simple example of tweaking genes, irrespective of what other trade-offs there might be, but tweaking genes for longevity. Mm-hmm. If a parent announces, I'm going to tweak my kid's genes because to only live 50 years because I think life is sweeter if you only live 50 years, we should take that off the table because that would, harm them.
Yep.
But then you have the choice between tweaking them for an extra 20 years of longevity or an extra 50 years of longevity. And why wouldn't then the state say we should strongly encourage all parents to give the extra 50 years tweak, because otherwise it's the same as a parent denying a child 30 extra years of life?
Right. Well, I don't know. I guess I don't think there's an overwhelming argument against the idea of, I mean, 3 score years and 10 not necessarily being something that we should be obliged to conform with. But sort of anyway, only have to, I guess it's now the average life expectancy in most countries is beyond 3 score years and 10. But, I mean, I suppose I feel sufficiently convinced by what, I guess, another bio-Luddite, Francis Fukuyama, says there's a downside to living to 150. I mean, you want to sort of arrive at 150 in a sort of a fit state to actually enjoy being at 150. And I think there's plenty of examples from our society of people who live a long time or are living sort of when you look at it, I mean, not all people would say this, but you can imagine many people saying, well, I don't know, I think I lived 10 years too long. I mean, I lived up to 70. I was a productive. I was basically sort of pursuing a life plan, and those extra 10 years that I've got medical technology gave me, well, I actually made no good use of. And furthermore, I think my life considered as a whole is kind of worse with them.
Hmm. Well, your book isn't primarily about life extension, but the life extenders call that the Tithonus fallacy, and the notion that the Tithonus was a Roman Greek mythological character who wished for extended life, but it didn't ask for extended youth, and he ended up a bag of bones in a bucket. But mm-hmm. The notion seems to be fallacious, because probably the most likely way that we will have extended longevity is by retarding, reversing aging, or modifying our morbidity processes in ways that we already see. There's been a compression of morbidity. So yes, if the trade-off was that we all ended up on in intensive care for the last 50 years of our life, I don't think many of us would want that. But at any rate, your book isn't about life extension.
No, I guess I think that's fine. That's great. I mean, I do think that sort of if a parent chose to gift their child with extra
youth
life genes.
Yeah.
Then that would be a choice. I mean, I guess I don't see anyone. I don't see a powerful argument for why a parent. When Fukuyama presents these arguments, he presents them as if they're supposed to convince everyone that they're decisive considerations against life extension. And I certainly don't think they're that. But I can certainly see people who might, for a variety of religions, reasons, maybe some of them religious reasons, say, well, that's not for me. And furthermore, when I make my procreative choices, I don't want that for my children. And furthermore, I don't think that rules out a very worthwhile and good life for my children, just because I haven't designed them so that they will live until 130.
Let me move on to the more intriguing and unique aspect of your argument, which I think is the one around nature. And that is one that at least I don't read very often, because most of the transhumanist folks that I consort with are interested in quite unnatural abilities. But mm-hmm. you make the argument, which I think is a good one, that if people are comfortable with a range of human diversity that includes quite unnatural extremes that occur naturally, mm-hmm. and don't want to, you know, as Harrison Bergeron's story by Kurt Vonnegut suggests, that we should all be equal by making our extraordinary athletes and singers and so on less extraordinary, that no one mm-hmm. really wants to do that. So if that's okay, then why can't everyone participate in the in those extreme abilities as well? I like that argument. Mm-hmm. Are there other people making that argument? Has that argument had some traction?
I don't know. Well, I don't know if it's had any philosophical traction. I guess I'm sort of noticing the sort of the misuse of the concept of nature. I mean, basically, it's sort of something that the opposition have appropriated. I mean, basically, to say that genetic enhancement is unnatural as opposed to constitute an argument against it. I guess sort of, you know, turning nature over to its flip side and saying, well, I guess, you know, from a genetic perspective, you know, Richard Feynman probably had a sort of a nice complement of intelligence influencing genes. What was wrong with being Richard Feynman?
Right. An example I use in my book is that there's substantial evidence for a genetic component to our natural disposition, our quotient of happiness in our life, mm-hmm. and that people, regardless of what events occur to them, they generally return to this either dysthymic, relatively unhappy disposition or a relatively happy disposition. And I can't see a good argument why we all shouldn't have the accessible to us, the ability mm-hmm. to turn ourselves up to the maximum possible happiness quotient that people mm-hmm. have. The Brave New World scenario is the one that people throw out at me, but I don't see happy people as generally being more tolerant of oppression in society than the less happy people.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I guess if you think that there's something wrong, there's a decisive moral argument against genetically modifying an embryo so that it has the sort of the happier variants of those genes rather than the unhappier variants of them, I mean, you should find something that's wrong with people who were born with the happy variant, if you can't.
Right. Well, let me then turn finally to the part of your book where, again, I'm in great sympathy, which is the argument around the potential inequality and reduction of solidarity that these technologies might bring. And you point to an example, which I also have written about, which is the notion that people might adapt to oppressive social conditions by changing the, for instance, the skin color that they're being oppressed on the basis of. And you find that problematic. Mm-hmm. And in this case, you go outside of the liberal approach to these technologies. If I understand you correctly, you would be for forbidding parents, black parents, for instance, to adapt to racism by making their children white.
Mm-hmm.
And why would you want to deny them that kind of germinal choice when you are allowing so many others? Is it because...
Right. Well, I guess I take it that the idea of a sort of a liberal approach to these technologies is saying, well, look, you should be free to use them as you choose, but there are limits. I mean, just as, I don't know, I suppose the idea if you have a knife, you can be free to use it as you choose, but there certainly are limits to the things you can morally do with a knife. You can't stab people. And I suppose what we have an obligation here. We can't just sort of do the Leon Kass thing and say, yuck. But one thing we can do is sort of say, well, okay, one, maybe there's a moral limit that arises in respect of sort of burdens that are placed on other people. So
What if black parents went to a fertility clinic and said, I would like to choose white sperm and white eggs, and so that I can raise a child who won't suffer from the kind of prejudice that I suffered from? How would that be morally different from using a gene tweak to make their own genetic progeny white?
I suppose that the test for me, I mean, I guess I sort of think that, I mean, so long as there will be people, I mean, black people in our society, which there will be, that, I mean, if you find that basically a technology makes their situation worse, and that's basically the ground for a restriction on individual choice. And I suppose I think that, well, maybe, you know, that would be a reason. I mean, I guess it's sort of the consistency. You might say there's a consistency reason for sort of saying there's no difference between choosing white sperm and a white egg and, you know, actually sort of modifying the melanin-producing genes directly. But I suppose I think there could be a difference. I mean, if it's sort of, I mean, you know, it's an action which would be sort of maybe more marginal and actually could be described in other ways. I mean, going in and sort of directly modifying specific genes to influence skin color is something that really can only have one purpose. I mean, I guess it's in a way just sort of, it is surrendering to prejudice because you're actually not changing anything else, whereas I suppose you might give some other reason in addition to that for sort of saying, well, look, I just happen to prefer, from what I know about it, that white sperm and that white egg.
I guess my optimism about that particular scenario is that I think somatic gene therapy and other cosmetic enhancements that people will have access to will be far more successful than Michael Jackson's have been in allowing a kind of a wild diversity of skin types and colors. So, mm-hmm. you know, if a child wanted to, and the other reason I'm optimistic about that is that I don't find most parents wanting to have children that look terribly different from themselves.
No, I mean, I guess if this was just a sort of a marginal, I mean, the real test for me is sort of, does it make things worse off for other people? I mean, I guess if it imposes a significant burden, I mean, if it became something that sort of, I don't know, all rich black parents were doing, but none of the poor ones could afford to do it, you could imagine that generating a situation in which it just gets much, much worse to be black. But if it's a sort of a more, I mean, I guess if the consequence is kind of a huge diversity in skin colors, then I couldn't begin to see that as basically making or exacerbating prejudice.
So are you optimistic about the way things are going on the regulation of these technologies? Have you kept your eye on, for instance, the way that New Zealand or Europe is beginning to regulate these? I think that in general, you take a whack at the precautionary principle at the mm-hmm. end of the book, and I think in general that argument has had a lot of moral sway, at least in Europe, in saying that we should ban these technologies or at least go extremely slow with them because we don't know what the future consequences of a liberal approach might be.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess I sort of think, I mean, that kind of caution is, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. It's sort of in evolutionary terms, the idea of when you run into something unfamiliar, go slow is kind of a good idea. I mean, if you run into a sort of food that you've never encountered before, don't sort of taste it before you sort of gulp it all down. But I guess I sort of think that when I see the book, and well, my book and your book and other books, is basically, I guess, starting a kind of debate which would lead people sort of say, well, okay, caution was the right way to begin. But we've actually done a bit of thinking about these technologies now, and we can actually sort of recognize that there are some bad ways to use them, and we should ban those, but there are definitely some good ways to use them. So I guess that's something. I guess I have a general optimism about the efficacy of moral argument, that people do eventually get the point. They do eventually sort of, you know, emerge from behind their sort of Leon Cassian shield and sort of say, well, okay, I can see that sort of it's time to walk away from yuck now because I'm getting a better understanding of what people are talking about.
That's a wonderful place to end on that note of optimism, which most people don't bring to this particular topic. I've been speaking with Nicholas Agar. He's a senior lecturer in philosophy at the University of Victoria, Wellington, New Zealand, and the author of three books of interest to Change Surfer Radio listeners, Life's Intrinsic Value, The Perfect Copy, which is about cloning, and Liberal Eugenics, most recently. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you. It was great.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.